Lecture 20, The Bible in English.
Hello, and welcome to the English Bible. In this lecture, I'm going to survey some of the changes in the history of the English language that we've been looking at by concentrating on the history of biblical translation. Almost from the beginning of the English language, the Bible was translated or paraphrased into the vernacular. And the history of Bible translation is the history of the English language and the history of its usage. In order to do this, we will be returning to texts in Old English and Middle English, looking at a translation also from the early 16th century, and concluding with the King James Bible published in 1611. I have a selection of passages that I think exemplify some of the changes in the history of the language and the ways in which biblical translators use the resources of their own tongue to articulate biblical sense and sensibility. The passage that I've chosen is a small selection from the New Testament, from the book of Matthew, Matthew 17, verses 13 to 15. It's a selection from the story of the prodigal son. And so you have a sense of what I'm really talking about. I'm going to read you the passage first in the familiar King James Version. Matthew 17, verse 13. Then the disciples understood that he spake unto them of John the Baptist. And when they were come to the multitude, there came to him a certain man, kneeling down to him and saying, Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is lunatic and sore vexed, for oft times he falleth into the fire and oft into the water. Now, even a passage this short can give you a sense of the flavor of the King James, what's called the paratactic structure, the repetition of ands or of conjunctions at the beginning of sentences, the way in which particular words or collocations of words evoke both the Old English and the imported, the native and the loan word. And the sense, too, that particular words have about them a kind of almost psychological or medical connotation. Have mercy on my son, for he is lunatic and sore vexed. Etymologically, lunatic, of course, means under the sway of the moon. And it's a nice word to focus on because it reminds us, too, of the way in which writers on the history of the English language thought of the mutability of their own tongue. William Caxton had talked about English being, as he said, under the domination of the moon, always waxing and waning. And in later lectures, we will see how Samuel Johnson, the writer of the dictionary in the middle of the 18th century, will use the term sublunary to describe that same kind of earthly condition. And here, lunatic is, as it were, a kind of touchstone for an understanding of behavior that's not just strange or mad or odd or unusual, but which is the condition of living in the world. Now, if we were to go back from King James to the Old English, we would see a version of the Bible that's almost incomprehensible. Strange, but I also want to suggest more familiar than we might imagine. Then the disciples understood that he spake unto them of John the Baptist. Now, in the Old English translation, prepared in about the 10th century A.D., that verse reads, Tha onyten his learning knishtas, that he het sede be Joanna them full uchtera. Now, disciples, that's King James. What's the Old English word? The Old English word is learning knishtas. What is it? Learning knishtas, the knights of learning. If you are a knight of learning, you're a student or a disciple. If you're a king of learning, you're a teacher or a master. But in this case, learning knishtas means student or disciple. It translates the Latin discipulus. And what it is it's a kenning. Remember Old English poetry. Remember Cadman. Remember the way in which the Anglo-Saxons coined new words. Here you have a bit of poetry, a kenning, a piece of Old English diction translating a biblical Latin term. The learning knights. Joanna vam full uchtera. Full uchtera. That literally means the completely wetterer. The one who would fully dunk you or place you in the water. That's the Baptist. John the Baptist is John the fully wetter. And when they were come to the multitude, and tha he come to thera menegu. Now the menegu is just the many, the multitude here, the menegu. There came to him a certain man, kneeling down to him and saying, him to yenealakta, some man, ye begedum kneoum to foran him, and quith, kneoum, knee. On ye begedum kneoum, on bended knees. And they're ye nealakta, literally nea, they're neared to him, a man, some man, ye begedum kneoum. I've talked a lot about inflectional endings, and I've talked about how Old English is a highly inflected language. Well, ye begedum kneoum, those UM endings are masculine plural datives. It doesn't really matter that we know this in detail. What matters is that you recognize that Old English has to work this way, and that this is more important than the word order. What communicates meaning are those endings. And he said, Lord, have mercy on my son. Drichten. Remember Cadman's hymn? Drichten. The old word for the Germanic political ruler, now transferred to the divine ruler. Have mercy on my son. Yemilza minum sunna. In Old English, that phrase means yemilza, be mild unto my son. Have mildness to my son. Because he's lunatic and sore vexed. And in Old English, what is he? He is stille seak. He's falling sick. He has the falling sickness. Perhaps a medical condition, but again, an Old English compound pressed into the service of explaining a biblical term. And, the Old English goes on, evil tholath. And he suffers badly, sore vexed. The verb tholian in Old English has completely dropped out of the language. I think it's a beautiful and evocative word. It means to suffer, but it also means to be patient in some sense. Christ suffered. The verb used would be tholian. He suffered for sins. An individual suffers in that way. And he filth on fear. He falls down on the fire. And yelomlich, and often on water. On water. Now there are many interesting things about this passage in the Old English, and some of them I've already illustrated. The use of a poetic metaphorical vocabulary to translate biblical Latin terms. The use of compounds, in particular, to give voice to Christian concepts in familiar ways, and the way in which this passage nicely illustrates the highly inflected sense of the language. One point of syntax I want to make here, and I think is worth pausing over, is the way in which Old English indicates conditional clauses. That is, in modern English, we use the words when and then to distinguish sequence of action. When something happened, then I did that. We use two different words. Now, in Old English, speakers and writers would have only used one word, tha. Tha becomes our word, though, or then, in some senses. The word tha in Old English can mean when or then. How do you know? How do you distinguish between the meaning when and the meaning then? Old English writers distinguished here by changing word order. If you had a line, tha, followed by the verb and the subject, that meant then. Tha onyutun his learning knichtas. Tha onyutun, verb, is learning knichtas, subject. That means then. Go to the next line. And tha he come. Tha he is the subject. Verb is the word come. Tha he come means when. This is an important distinction because it shows us how Old English writers could express changes using word order rather than changes in vocabulary. This is also interesting because there is a moment in the history of English when there is a kind of redundancy. That is, when writers can use both word order patterns and changes in vocabulary to indicate these differences. Let's go back to Chaucer on this. Quam that apro with his shorter softer, the drochter marcheth, passeth to the rochter. And bothered every vein and switch liqueur of which vertu engendered is the floor. Juan, Zephyrus ache with his sway to breath, and spirit hath in every halt and hath the tundra cropus, and the younger sonna hath in the realm of halva course runner, and so on and so on and so on. When, verb, when, subject, verb, excuse me, Juan April, with his shortest sota, blah, blah, blah. You get to the end of that long, long passage, and then Chaucer gives us, than longen, folk to go on pilgrimages. Not than folk longen, than longen folk. Then, verb, subject. Chaucer is using that word order pattern not because of the requirements of meter and not for emphasis. He's using the word order pattern because it's a holdover of this older, old English way of indicating then. When is the subject verb, then is the verb subject. And even in Chaucer's Middle English, when the words when and then come into use in these special ways, there's still that leftover. It's kind of redundant. What happens to the Bible in Chaucer's English? During the 1380s, contemporary with Chaucer, a man named John Wycliffe had established what scholars now see as a kind of heretical movement. It was called Lollardy. From the Lollards, Lollardy is a word, Lollards, it's a word from the Dutch, which sort of means mumble or murmur, in some sense. The Lollards were a heretical sect, because they believed in many things that, in fact, later Protestants would come to believe in. Things like the possibility of reading the Bible in English, which the Catholic Church was very much against. The possibility of changing some of the sacraments. The possibility of faith as your primary vehicle for grace. Now, many of the Lollards were burned at the stake. Their writings were condemned or destroyed. But they had a great impact on English social and cultural life in the later Middle Ages. And one of the great projects of Wycliffe and his Lollard followers was to translate the Bible into English so everyone could read it. And in the 1380s, Wycliffe translates this passage that I've read to you in the following way. Some disciples understanden that of John the Baptist he had said to him. Now we've got, it's so familiar now. Disciples, he keeps the Latin word. It's no longer this old English kenning, learning knichts in some ways. Understood that of John the Baptist now has his name. And he said to them, and when he come to the company of people, a man come to him, folded on knees before him, saying, he came to the company of people. Not the menigu now, not the many, but this sense of a company of people on folded on knees before him. Lord, have mercy on me sonna, for he is lunatic and suffereth evil. For why oft times he falleth into the fear and oft times into water. Now, in the 1380s, John Wycliffe can inflect the language with Latin, but also with French. Yemiltzeminum sunum, the old English phrase, rich with resonances, of that heroic sense of a Lord having mildness or magnanimity becomes now, in French, merci. Have mercy on my son. Words like company and people. People is a French loan word here. And suffer. These are key concept words. And the important thing to see in Wycliffe's translation, just as I've stressed in so many of my earlier lectures on the history of the language, is that the place where vocabulary change goes on is in the key concept words of the language, or in this case, the key concept words of the passage. Wycliffe and his translators are primarily interested in conveying what's important about this passage by using words now not from Old English, but from the newer French vocabulary. And you can see, too, just as in the passage I gave you from Chaucer, from the Canterbury Tales, you can see how Wycliffe, again, is maintaining that old word order pattern. Than discipulis understanden. Than, verb, subject. And wan he kam. When, subject, verb. He has the words then and when, but he still keeps the old word order. This is, I think, terribly significant. It's what we call redundancy, when you have basically two functional areas of a language or two ways of expressing the same thing, and you do them at the same time. Wycliffe's version seems familiar to us because in many ways he provides a model for later Bible translators. When William Tyndale came to translate the Bible in the early 16th century, he did so not just by going back to the original biblical texts, but also by going back to some of these earlier English translations. Now, Tyndale's Bible was an act of illegality. In the 16th century, before the Reformation, when England is still a Catholic country, it is illegal to produce a translation of the Bible. And Tyndale, highly influenced by the incipient Protestant movements on the continent, has to have his Bible published in the 1520s in Geneva. So it's an English Bible, but it's published in Europe. And look at Tyndale's choices now. Then his disciples perceived, not then the disciples understood. Now this perceived word, this is not a word that appears in Wycliffe, nor is it the word that appears in the King James Bible. This is Tyndale's own intrusion, as it were, a way of perhaps almost psychologizing this, to see into, to perceive, that he spake unto them of John the Baptist. And when they were come to the people, there came to him a certain man and kneeled down to him, saying, Master, have mercy on my son, for he is frantic and is sore vexed, and oft times falleth into the fire and oft times into the water. Now, this looks sort of familiar, but it also looks a little, how can I put it, off base, let's say. There are occasional words like perceived or frantic instead of lunatic that are Tyndale's incursions here. Now, let me just pause and say, Tyndale did, in fact, have a great deal of influence on the King James Bible. Tyndale coins such phrases as, eat, drink, and be merry. That's Tyndale. That's just an idiom. I mean, we think of that as almost a phrase without a history. But it's a phrase that's coined by a biblical translator. Tyndale's Bible is full of these things, and the translators of the King James Bible also looked to Tyndale. I think what's at stake in looking at these different versions is not just vocabulary choice, but sense of idiom. Or to put it another way, to go back to some of the things I was trying to explore in earlier lectures, the difference between an elevated style and a colloquial style. It seems to me that Tyndale's style, compared to the King James, is somewhat more self-consciously elevated. Tyndale wishes to create a biblical language that sounds memorable, that uses words that will stay in the mind, that elevate the tone to something spiritual or religious. The King James Bible translators, I believe, try to strike a balance between the elevated and the colloquial, so that when we see the King James Bible version compared to Tyndale and Wycliffe, what we see in effect are those translators going back to an earlier form, as it were, arcing over Tyndale, and perhaps choosing more colloquial or familiar phrases than the disciples understood. Seems perfectly straightforward. That he spake unto them of John the Baptist. And when they were come now, it's not when they were come to the people or to the company of people, but what King James does is at this point, the translators give us a sense not of the colloquialism, but of the vastness, the power, the multitude. And when they were come to the multitude, it's a word like that that comes in to this very simple set of phrases that hooks your attention. And when they were come to the multitude, there came to him a certain man, kneeling down to him and saying, it seems to me, the only way that I can put it is to put it this way. It seems to me that the genius of the King James translators is to find the right word as a kind of verbal vanishing point. The moment where your attention is riveted. The sentence I read, verse 14, and when they were come to the multitude, there came to him a certain man kneeling down to him and saying, ordinary words, small words, English words, words almost exclusively from the Old English vocabulary. And yet, in the dead center of that sentence is the word multitude. That's where your eye has to land. That's where your ear has to hear the importance of that. Lord, have mercy on my son. Not master, but Lord. For he is lunatic and sore vexed. Lunatic is from Wycliffe. Sore vexed is from Tyndale. King James, in the phrase lunatic and sore vexed, gives us, as it were, a synthesis of what its translators imagine to be the best of both earlier versions. And in that synthesis, they create a collocation that resonates to this day. Lunatic and sore vexed. There are moments in King James, I'd like to suggest, when what we're reading really is not prose at all, but English poetry. To say that King James sounds Shakespearean is to say not simply that it uses a vocabulary or a phraseology of the Renaissance, but it is to say, too, that like Shakespeare, the King James translators are much aware of prosody and meter. Lunatic and sore vexed. You can feel it. Or you can feel it, too, if you remember the Shakespeare passages I read. You'll remember how, in the Hamlet, the whole sense of the rhythm of a line moves in that way. So similarly, Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is lunatic and sore vexed. For oft times he falleth into the fire, and oft into the water. Alliteration, falleth into the fire. This takes us back all the way to Old English. For if there is a poetry to the Old English, it is also not just a poetry of the word, but a poetry of the line. You will remember, too, that Old English poetry alliterated. Filth on fear is the Old English version of that line, as if it were a fossil of an alliterative phrase. And so what I'm suggesting is that the sound, the structure, and the texture of the King James here synthesizes or seeks to synthesize what its translators imagine to be the best of English biblical translation. Now let me move to some sort of larger general claims, because the King James Bible will, as I hope to suggest in later lectures, be one of the core texts that influence the shape and texture of English, and in particular, of American English of the 19th century. One of the idioms of King James, it seems to me, that the King James translators learn from Tyndale is this unique phrasing, were come or is come. We think of this as, to put it bluntly, Bible talk. He is come. They were come. What's going on here? Is this grammar or is this style? We would say he has come. But it seems to me that what's at stake here is a kind of conscious archaism on the part of Tyndale. This is something which is not really in the Middle English or even in the Old English. But I think it's a sense or a recognition that we can see in certain languages, going back to my discussion of modal verbs, the way in which certain kinds of verbs take other kinds of verbs as their helpers. Let me make an analogy to another language. In modern German, when you want to express just having done something, you use the verb or forms of the verb to have. But if you want to express a change in state or a change in condition, you use forms of the verb to be. So if you wanted to say something like, I have grown, you'd say, ich bin gewachsen. Bin is the form of the verb to be. But we in English translate it as, I have grown. I think part of what's going on here in this unique biblical idiom is an attempt to evoke that much older, archaic, Germanic verbal texture. A verb that indicates a change of state or condition, like come, takes now not a form of the verb to have, but a form of the verb to be. This is characteristically biblical language. Another thing that's characteristically biblical is the address to God in the informal or the singular. As in the other languages of Europe, the Bible in English addresses God as a thou. What's very interesting about this is that in the reception of the Bible, and in particular the reception of the King James Bible, we come to associate thou with an elevated kind of speech. And when we think, for example, of the language of the Quakers of the 18th and 19th century, we think of thou and thee as a rarefied and elevated form of speech. Of course, the Quakers thou and thee to everybody because they spoke to everybody as an equal. It was not condescension. It was true informality. I am no better than my brother. Therefore, we should all speak in the informal. We should all, as one would say in French, tutoyer everyone. Let's eliminate this pattern. The speech of the Quakers is just old enough historically to recall that distinction between thou forms and you forms. But because these are rarefied or distinct or for us somewhat alien forms of speech, the language of the King James Bible or the language of the Quakers has suggested to us falsely that thou is formal and elevated and you is familiar. But it is, in fact, precisely the opposite. What we think of as biblical style, parallelism, repetition, the use of what I've called paratactic structures, the use of constructions like and but, all of these are things which come together into the biblical style. In subsequent lectures, I'm going to be drawing again and again on King James and its translators for the basis of the elevated biblical style. And we will see in writers as diverse as Walt Whitman, Abraham Lincoln, Herman Melville, Mark Twain, Joel Chandler Harris, writers of the American 19th century, an attempt to go back to the flavor of King James, to offer us the bits and pieces of biblicism, and in the process create a narrative form, not just unique to American language, but looking back to the history of English as encoded in this history of biblical translation. Thank you.